Hello everyone, my name is Elijah Davis, minister of the 12th Hour Apostolic Sabbatarian Congregation, Mount Zion, 12th Hour, in the Elgin, Texas. Today is September the 25th, 2025, or it is the 5th day of history, 2029. Our service today, we're going to deal with the Shepherd's Rod Class 1, D.C. Hollis. The question is, what is it? The Shepherd's Rod, that is. So that's the name of our sermon. The Shepherd's Rod, and what is it? This is the primary purpose of the Shepherd's Rod is to unlock the long concealed mystery concerning the ever challenging and much discussed subject of the 144,000, Revelation 14:1. With the simple object in view of the bringing about among Yahweh's people that thorough reformation foretold by the Spirit of Prophecy, Testimony Volume 8, 251, these truths divinely revealed are of the supreme importance to the Church. Just now, because of the trying, sifting circumstances through which Yahweh's people are soon to pass, being a vital concern for salvation, they call for the decided action from the ministry and laity alike to separate themselves from all worldliness and to anchor themselves on the solid rock by the obedience unto all of the truth known to the Church. If they would escape the forthcoming ruin, that is to take every sinner. For its dominant doctrinal concern, being the truth of the 144,000, and a correct understanding of it being a life and death matter to all, the Rod unfolds it from several different angles, each urging the denomination to prepare for the glorious deliverance of the saints and against the inglorious destruction of the sinners as foretold by the marking and the slain recorded in Ezekiel 9. No new denomination is advocated. On the contrary, such is unmitigatedly opposed and finally irrefutable proof is brought forth that the Seventh-day Adventist denomination has been the instrumentality of the Yahweh since 1844 for the carrying on of his work on the earth, and that the rod adds the power and force to the third message. Early Writings, page 277. For the purporting to be as the antitype of the first Exodus, the Shepherd's Rod takes its name from the Moses' Rod, the instrument through which the Yahweh manifested his power. Or let's do it again. Which the Yahshua, the Son of Yahweh, manifested his power and the deliverance of the children of Israel, for the shepherd's rod as the only rod that has ever spoken, is predicted and recommended in the Micah 6:9. Hear ye the rod and him who hath appointed it. This is the first revised edition of the Shepherd's Rod, Volume 1, originally published in 1930. To make it a handy packet-sized book, since dealt with in the other numbers of this series of the publication have been omitted, and its subject matter condensed. And in compliance with Yahshua's command, we should now with the open ears hear the rod's message. The seeding of the first fruits, 144,000. That's our next subtitle. And I saw another angel ascending from the east, having the seal of the living Yahweh. And he cried with a loud voice unto the four angels, unto whom he was given to hurt the earth and the sea, saying, hurt not the earth, neither the sea, nor the tree, till we have sealed the servants of our Yahweh in their foreheads. And I heard the number of them which were sealed, and there were sealed 144,000 of all the tribes of the children of Israel. Revelation 7:2-4. For the mystery concerning the sealing of the 144,000 is probably pure unto any fixed Bible subject. For the theory has called a theory only. Let's read that again. For the theory has crowded the theory only for the more to mystify and confuse the truth of it. No antitypical apostolic believer No Christian denomination of the Sunday-keeping world seems to have escaped the controversy that in their giving rise unto the many divergent views has only increased the rift in the Protestant lute, L-U-T-E. This has been exceedingly regrettable, and very much the more so among us as the Seventh-day Adventist, for the long ago the messenger of the Yahweh admonished us to strive with all the power of the Yahweh that the Yahweh has given us to be among the 144,000. Review and Herald, March 9, 1905. And then, graciously placed in our hands the necessary knowledge for the time then present as to when and where, why, and what the sealing is. This sealing of the servants of Yahweh. The Yahweh revealed is the same that was shown unto Ezekiel in the vision. Testimonies to Ministers 4:4-5, Ezekiel 9, and any amplification of the subject the messenger wrote, especially in the closing work for the Seventh-day Adventist Church, in the sealing time of the 144,000 who are to stand without the fall before the throne of Yahweh Well, they feel most deeply the wrongs of Yahweh's professed people. Testimonies, Volume 3, page 266. Accordingly, the marking takes place in the church because of the abomination practiced in her midst. Hence, the removal of those who foster the abomination is her chosen work, not the world. With this key knowledge in the hand, the church is to have gone enlightenedly. Let's read that again. With this key knowledge in the hand, the church is to have gone on enlightenedly with the progress of the truth, and at the appointed time be enabled for the unlocking of the mystery, the failing to obey the garland of, or let's do it again, failing to obey the voice of the Yahshua, Son of Yahweh, and thus to walk in the light, and to advance from knowledge to knowledge, she lost her way, and consequently has for years wandered in the wilderness of the theories, so to speak. And while she was in the confusion on the subject, the Spirit of the Truth pronounced silence on it, then to be eloquent. The eloquence for how long? Forever? Obviously not, but only until the Yahshua himself should unroll the scroll, the seating commence, and the subject become present to it. Then silence could no longer be eloquent. In fact, not even possible. Not if there are ever to be 144,000 sealed and made ready to stand with the Lamb on the Mount Zion, Revelation 14:1. A thorough going knowledge of the subject must necessarily be of as great importance as is a comprehensive knowledge of the Daniel 7, Revelation 13:17. The three angels' messages of Revelation 14 or any other revealed Bible mission or prophecy. And how can one escape the slaughter unless one knows what the sealing marking is, when it is, and where it is to begin, or where it is to be. So while on the one hand is seen the utter necessity and hence the absolute certainty of the inspiration fully unfolding the subject at the time of the closing work for the church, on the other hand is seen the consequent utter impossibility of anyone discovering the whole truth beforehand. Any thinker knows that to have made known the truth of it before time would have left it as vain, valueless, and ineffective as would making known the truth about the image of the beast years before or a minute after it does its deceptive work, that of the striking of the foreordained hour, the time inspiration unlocks the mystery. All can behold the truth and profit by it happily. quick and then intelligently strive to be among this godless company and can be sealed with them if we sincerely and steadfastly follow on to know the truth on time. When the someone asks, closing work for the church, let's read that again. When someone asks, when will this closing work for the church begin? Obviously, it is already in the progress. Light is pouring in upon the subject, dispelling the darkness, which has long enveloped it, having consequently become present truth, for the lightning of the way in which 144,000 are to follow the Lamb, whithersoever he goeth, Revelation 14:4, it must be proclaimed as from the housetop. In 1844, as all Seventh-day Adventists know, Sister White was given a vision of the 144,000, signalizing the sealing angels starting his ascent from the east, Revelation 7:2-4. From then on, he was ascending, and the saints were awaiting his arrival. Finally, in 1929, through the Sabbath school lesson, Yahweh announced throughout the Seventh-day Adventist denomination worldwide that the angel had arrived. Then the scroll began to unroll, and the angel's presence to be felt by many of these who were agonizing for the truth and righteousness. But how can we know for sure, another question, that this and companion publications are the genuine fruit of the unrolling of the scroll and of the sealing angel's arrival? Simply, if the claimant herein on a trial is vindicated by all the relevant scriptures and other inspired testimony. And if it is, then the only admissible conclusion is that the divinely appointed and long awaited hour has struck, and that this literature is the instrument used by the inspiration to make the event known unto Yahweh's people. Since, as we have previously seen from the spirit of the prophecy, the sealing and the slaughter takes place in the church during the closing work for the church, for they could not antedate the present time. And the prophecy itself shows that the sealing must begin at a time when her spiritual life is at its lowest ebb, and she is polluted with sin and the exceeding great iniquity, Ezekiel 9:9. For it is her defiled condition that causes a holy Yahweh to do in her midst the work of the marking, sealing the saint, and of doing away with the sinners among them. How did she start to reach this condition? Well, the servant of Yahweh sadly answered, Yahweh has not closed heaven unto us, but our own course of the continual backsliding has separated us from the Yahweh. Pride, covetousness, and the love of the world have lived in the heart without the fear of banishment or condemnation. Grievous and presumptuous sins have brought to mind. And yet the general opinion is that the church is flourishing and that peace and spiritual prosperity are in all her borders. Part 2, page 11. Just start with the last paragraph on our track, Shepherd Rod. Track. For the Yahweh has not closed heaven unto us, but our own course of the continual backsliding has separated us from the Yahweh. Pride, covetousness, and love of the world have lived in the heart without fear of the banishment or condemnation. Grievous and presumptuous sins have dwelt among us, and yet the general opinion is that the church is flourishing and that peace and the spiritual prosperity are in all her borders. For the church has turned back from following Yahshua, her leader, and is steadily retreating toward Egypt. Yet few are alarmed or astonished at their want of the spiritual power. Doubt and even disbelief of the testimony of the Spirit of Yahweh is living our churches everywhere. Testimony, Volume 5, page 217. We have wandered away from the old landmark. Let us return. If the Yahweh be Yahweh, serve him. If Baal, serve him. Which side will you be on? Page 137, Volume 5, Testimony. As the Yahshua views the state of his professed followers today, he sees a base ingratitude, hollow formalism, hypocritical insincerity, pharisaical pride, and apostasy. Who can truthfully say our gold is tried in the fire? Our garments are unspotted by the world. I saw our instructor pointing to the garments of the so-called righteousness, stripping them off. He laid bare the defilement beneath. Then said to me, "Can you not see how they have pretentiously covered up the defilement and rottenness of the character? How is the faithful city becoming harlot? My father's house is made a house of merchandise, a place whence the divine presence and glory have departed. For this cause, there is weakness and strength is lacking." Testimony, Volume 8, page 250. For the time has come for the earnest and powerful efforts to rid the church of the slime and filth which is tarnishing her purity. Testimony, Ministry 450. Thus, with the humiliating certainty, we are made to see and to acknowledge that the condition of the church is deplorable in the sight of Yahweh. Testimony, Volume 3, page 253. And it is a mournfully admitted fact among all the informed and honest throughout the 70 Adventist Church that though she has 4 years been four years been steadily declining spiritually, she has never hitherto reached her present low level where she retains scarcely any of her former distinction from the world. Spiritual death, laments the voice of the inspiration, has come upon the paper that should be manifest in life and zeal security and consecration by their most earnest devotion to the cause of the truth. The facts concerning the real condition of the professed people of Yahweh speak more loudly than their profession and make it evident that some power has touched the table that anchors them to the eternal rock, and that they are drifting away to sea without shore or compass. Christ our righteousness, 36. Men and women are in the last hours of the probation, and yet are careless and stupid, and ministers have no power to arouse them. They are asleep themselves. Sleeping preachers preaching to a sleeping people. Testimony, Volume 2, page 337. Indeed, the conviction is gaining ground in the world that the Seventh-day Adventists are giving the trumpet an uncertain sound, that they are following in the path of the worldling. Testimony to Ministers 86. For all these, and for other reasons, some of which we know not, a pure and holy Yahweh is whetting his sword in heaven to cut down those who do not sigh and cry. Oh, that every lukewarm profession could realize the clean work that Yahweh is about to make among his professed people. Testimony, Volume 1, page 190. Mark this point with care. Those who receive the pure mark of the truth wrought in them by the power of the Holy Spirit, represented by and marked by the man in linen, are those that sigh and that cry for all the abominations that be done in the church. Volume 3, page 267. For the seal of Yahweh will be placed upon the foreheads of those only who sigh and cry for all the abominations done in the land. Testimony, Volume 5, page 212. Necessarily, while the investigative judge is going forward in heaven, while the sins of the penitent believers are being removed from the sanctuary, there is to be a special work of the purification, as the putting away sins among Yahweh's people upon the earth. The Great Controversy, 425. Now that this special work is on, there is no longer any doubt that the days of the purification of the church are hastening on apace. For Yahweh will have a people pure and true, and a mighty sifting soon is to take place. We shall be better able to measure the strength of Israel. The signs reveal that the time is near when the Yahshua, the Son of Yahweh, will manifest that his fan is in his hand, and he will thoroughly purge his floor. Testimony, Volume 5, page 80. Another memorable vision of this same crucial work, Sister White saw angels hurrying to and fro in the heaven, descending to the earth, and again ascending into heaven, preparing for the fulfillment of some important event. Then I saw another mighty angel. She continued, commission to descend to the earth to unite his voice with the third angel and give power and force unto his message. Great power and glory was imparted to the angel. And as he descended the earth of light with his glory, this message seemed to be an addition to the third message, to the third angel's message. 3 Rogers 2:77. And only those that savors the spirit of the truth, who have withstood the temptation and the strength of the mighty one, will be permitted to act as a part in the proclaiming of the third angel's message. When it shall have spread into the loud cry, again, here on November 19, 1908, for the great issue, so near at hand, will weed out those whom Yahweh has not appointed, and he will have a pure, a true sanctified ministry prepared for the latter rain. Why are the sinners taken from among the righteous before the earth is lightened with the glory of the angel? Because one sinner may diffuse darkness that will exclude the light of Yahweh from the entire congregation. Testimony, Volume 3, page 265. For the clear sequence of the facts here brought to view conclusively points out that we are now in the closing work for the church at the sitting time of the 144,000, that the sealing, marking, sifting, shaking, special work, important event, closing work, and purification all result alike in the destruction of the unsealed and in the purification of the sealed. Yes, this is the preparation for the time of the Sabbath. Well, yeah, sure. It's a loud cry. The closing work for the church. Obviously, then, the closing message for the church is proclaimed by the faithful only, and Yahweh's people during the plague are apart by themselves with no unfaithful among them. So the subject of the 144,000, with its interrelated subject, coming into their clear, harmonious focus, shows that the elect, I can't read that word, or the 11th, the hour call, let's read that last sentence again. So the subject of the 144,000 with his interrelated subjects coming into their pure harmonious focus shows that the 11th hour call for the laborers, that's actually the 12th hour call, now that would translate, call for the laborers in the Yahshua's vineyard, Isaiah 5:7, is now in the progress. And that now is the time to strive with all the power Yahweh has given us to be among the 144,000. Review and Herald, March 9, 1905. And now this identification of the 144,000 has caused the identity of the great multitude, Revelation 7:9. To become almost as mooted a question. So the responsibility assumed to this, in this series to identify the former, the first fruits, and poses a commensurate responsibility to identify the latter, the second fruits of the great multitude. After this I beheld, and lo, a great multitude which no man could number, of all the nations and kindreds and people and tongues, stood before the throne and before the Lamb, clothed with their white robes, and psalms in their hands, Revelation 7:9. Leading to the identification of this great multitude, inspiration has given us several clues, one of which is a classification of the redeemed of all ages, from the martyrdom of Abel until the close of probation. We'll start with group one. Nearest the throne are those who were once zealous in the cause of the Satan, but who plucked as a branch from the burning, have followed their Savior with the deepest and intense devotion. Number two. Next are those who perfected Christian characters in the midst of the falsehood and infidelity, those who honored the law of Yahweh when the Christian world declared it void. Number three, and the millions of all ages who were martyred for their faith. Number four, and beyond is a great multitude which no man could number, of all nations and kindreds and people and tongues, before the throne and before the Lamb, clothed with the white robes, and palms in their hands. Great Controversy 665. Here a momentous question. Press this for answer. Since we are plainly shown that the great multitude, group four, are a company separate from the plucked branch, group one, from the overcomers of the falsehood and infidelity, group two, and from the martyrs of all time, group three, how can a great multitude possibly be composed of the saints of all ages, of all the redeemed? Very obviously they cannot. Consequently, if they are not group one, two, or three, then who can they be but the living saints? And since there are not the 144,000, let's read that all over again. Consequently, if they are not group one, two, or three, then who can they be but the living saints? And since they are not the 144,000, the first fruits of the living, they must then be the second fruits. Indeed, there must be second fruits, where the term first fruits calls for second fruits, just as much as the term first resurrection, Revelation 20 verse 6, calls for a second resurrection. And as much as the term second death, Revelation 20:14, calls for a first death. Nevertheless, still another baffling question requires an answer. If you ask his query, when the Son of Man cometh, shall he find faith on the earth? Luke 18:8. Also his statement, fear not, little flock, Luke 12:32, means that few are to be saved and found living when he comes for his own, then how can there be an innumerable multitude? Though at first glance, the question propounds a paradox that is quickly resolved, and the idea that only a few living saints are to meet him in the air is effectively dissipated when the account is taken of the fact that the harvest truly is plenteous, Matthew 9:37. That it is the end of the world, Matthew 13:39. Let's do that again. That it is in the end of the world, Matthew 13:39. And that the very term harvest itself denotes a larger gathering than at any previous season. Furthermore, the query, shall he find faith on the earth, is not questioning the number of the saints at this particular coming, but rather faith itself regardless of the number, and if that is appearing in the clouds to take home the faithful, he finds no faith in the earth, then what about his awaiting church, which is to be without spot or wrinkle or any such thing, be it small or great? Obviously, his coming recorded in Luke 18:8 cannot be the one of 1 Thessalonians 4:17. His coming in the clouds, but it could be the one of Malachi 3:2-3, and Matthew 13:30, 47-48. Leading to Matthew 25:31-33. His coming to his temple is to separate the sinners from the saints, at the commencement of which time inspiration asks, who may abide the day of his coming? And now, in the prophet's own words, comes the overall evidence of the ingathering of a great multitude of the living saints during the harvest time. And they, the 144,000, who escape the slain are abide the day, Isaiah 66:16, and the separation of the tares from the wheat, Matthew 13:30-41, the harvest of the first fruit, Revelation 14:4, the servants of the Yahweh, Revelation 7:3, shall bring all your brethren for an offering unto the Yahweh out of all nations, upon the horses, and then in chariots, and in litters, and upon mules, and upon swift beasts, to my holy mountain, Jerusalem, saith Yahweh, as the children of Israel bring an offering in a clean vessel into the house of Yahweh, Isaiah 66:20. Then was the iron, the clay, the brass, the silver, and the gold broken to pieces together and became like the chaff of the summer threshing floor, and the wind carried them away, that no place was found for them, and the stone that smote the image became a great mountain and filled the whole earth, Daniel 2:35. And it shall come to pass in the last days that the mountain of the Yahshua's house shall be established in the top of the mountains, and shall be exalted above the hills, and all nations shall flow unto it. And many people shall go and say, come ye, and let us go up unto the mountain of the Yahweh, unto the house of the Yahweh of the Jacob, Isaiah 2:2-3. Keeping these correlated forecasts steadily in view, none but the blind can fail to see that the idea of only a few saved is true only of the number saved during any pre-harvest message-bearing period, not though of the number saved during the harvest time itself. For the great multitude, the second fruits of the living saints, moreover, are also found projected into certain demonstration in the type. Number one, Moses upon the Mount of the Transfiguration was a witness unto the Yahshua's victory over sin and death. He represented those who shall come forth from the grave at the resurrection of the just. Desire of the Ages, page 421. Number two, and the graves were opened, and many bodies of the saints which slept arose and came out of the graves after his resurrection and went into the holy city and appeared unto many. Matthew 27:52-53. Early writings 184, Desire of Ages 786. Number three, for the Elijah who had been translated to heaven without seeing death represented those who will be living upon the earth at the Yahshua's second coming, and who will be changed in a moment in the twinkling of an eye at the last trump. The Desire of Ages, page 421. Number four, as the Enoch was translated to heaven before the destruction of the world by the water, so the living righteous will be translated from the earth before its destruction by the fire. Patriarchs and Prophets, page 89. In these passages, we are shown four types calling for the two companies of the resurrected saints and for the two companies of the translated saints. Since there are two types for the living, and as the Enoch himself was not a descendant of the Jacob, he cannot logically represent Jacob's descendants, the 144,000. In fact, the name Jacob, or the title Israelite, did not even come into existence until centuries after Enoch was translated. Logically typifies the 144,000, and Enoch logically typifies the great multitude who are from all nations and kindreds and people and tongues, Revelation 7:9, because from his generation have descended all nations. At the Master's final call, then appear in the beautiful symmetry the trophies of the gospel, the two hosts of the resurrection with their types, and two hosts of the translated with their types. Oh, what an ineffably wondrous and awesome sight. The glorious host of the redeemed sweeping through the portals of the glory and marching down the gold-paved streets of the paradise to the strains of the celestial anthem, which the mortal ear has never heard. Parades, behold it pass. First, the million of the escorting angels who ministered to the redeemed in all ages. Second, Moses, the first inspired penman, general, and leader, peerless among men, clothed in the white and crowned with a glittering golden crown, leading the van of the resurrected themselves, wearing white robes and golden crown. Third, Abel, first among the martyrs, leading the martyred host of the ages, all clad in the glorious white robes with the borders of the red. Fourth, Enoch, his head encircled with a dazzling white wreath, surrounded with a lovely crown brighter than the sun, and upon his arm a glorious palm, and following him a great multitude, all clothed in the pure white robes, with the palms in their hands, and golden crowns on their heads. Fifth, Elijah, the faithful, arrayed in a glorious white mantle from his shoulders to his feet, leading the 144,000, a royal priesthood, all like himself, attired in a glorious white mantle, or mantle. Six, the Adams, the son of Yahweh from the world of Yahweh's universe, with the father Adam in the van. Seventh, Yahshua, the King of Kings and Sovereign of Sovereigns, as the majesty of all creation, as the first and the last, and with him 10,000 times 10,000 and thousands of saints, throughout the infinite expanse of the eternity, never before has heaven beheld, and never again will it behold the like, a procession supernal. Brother, sister, it is ours to choose either the habiliments of the saved or the synchronments of the lost, either to walk with the ransomed in the white or lie down with the damned in black. If it be the latter, Yahweh forbid that it should be. Then the dreadful price must be not the first death alone, but also the second death, from which there is no relief. Yes, which will it be? Shrieking lamentations in the lake of the unquenchable fire, or the rapture songs at the fount of the unquenchable joy? Now, at the last hour, you will have to choose either the company of the Esau or Jacob, which? Esau or Jacob, which? And Isaac entreated the Yahweh for his wife, because she was barren. And Yahweh was entreated of him, and Rebekah his wife conceived. And the children struggled together while I was in her, and she said, if it be so, why am I thus? And she went to inquire the Yahweh. And the Yahweh said unto her, two nations are in thy womb, and two manner of people shall be separated from thy bowels, and the one people shall be stronger than the other people, and the elder shall serve the younger. And when her days to be delivered were fulfilled, behold, there were twins in her womb. And the first came out red all over like a hairy garment, and they called his name Esau. And after that came his brother out, and his hand took a hold on Esau's heel, and his name was called Jacob. Genesis 25:21-26. And the preternatural birth and the lives of Esau and Jacob, there is unmistakably divine design, and there is unmistakably a divine design and typology, or typology. Let's read that all again. In the preternatural birth and the lives of Esau and Jacob, there is an unmistakable divine design and typology for the strange anomaly of this family's experience, obviously dramatized in the miniature and experience through which Yahweh's church would one day pass. Rebekah herself was made well aware of this fact when the Yahweh said unto her, two nations are in thy womb, and two manner of people shall be separated from thy bowels, and the one people shall be stronger than the other people, and the older shall serve the younger. Verse 23. The typology in this throbbing life drama. Basically, that which stands forth in the Paul's interpretation are the equally intense drama of the Hagar and Ishmael, Sarah and Isaac. For the inspiration unveils the fact that the former pair represents the Old Testament church and its members, the Jews, and that the latter pair represents the New Testament church and its members, the Christians. Galatians 4:22-31. Similarly, though, in another faith, Rebecca also represents the Seventh-day Adventist church, while the Esau and Jacob represents her offspring, the laity. And since the two struggle within the mother before they were born, delivered, the important lesson is that while the church is travailing with her children just before they are delivered, receive the second birth, John 3:3, and are led into the kingdom of heaven here on earth, for they are to struggle within. So Rebecca carrying two sons makes known that the church is carrying within her two classes of people, Esau's and Jacob's. There are two opposing influences, affirms inspiration, continually exerted on the members of the church. One influence is working for the purification of the church, and the other for the corrupting of the people of Yahweh, Testimonies of Ministers, page 46. For the manner in which Esau and Jacob were born, Jacob's following Esau, has a hold of his heel, has very obvious significance. Esau's leading makes him a type of the leaders possessing his character, and Jacob's following makes him a type of the followers possessing his character. For this analogy unerringly signifies also that the one represents a class that precedes the other in church fellowship. Broadly speaking, therefore, they together represent candidates for a successor ministry and laity, respectively. There is also a typical significance in the further fact that Esau was born hairy and Jacob smooth. This outstanding external unlikeness obviously imports some kind of outstanding visible identification of the two classes typified. Yahweh ordained the man to lead and the woman to follow. And as much, he created the man hairy and the woman smooth. These divine marks of the distinction reveal that Esau and the class which he represents possess the natural equipment for the leadership, while Jacob and the class he represents do not. Besides being the firstborn, Esau by the birthright was to be the family priest. Through him were to come the progenitors of the 12 tribes, the prophets, the princes, and the kings of Israel, even the King of Kings himself, the Savior of the world. But the desires, ambitions, and aims of the Esau and Jacob ran counter to their inherited position. Esau had no special interest in the part of the work which his birthright permitted, whereas Jacob converted it, blocked, though by the law of the inheritance, from the possessing Esau's part, Jacob in his inordinate longing for the birthright managed to purchase it at the opportune time. Then in order to receive his father's blessing, he consented to his mother's conniving to obtain it through deceit. This brings in verse 5. This is our contact. This is the 11th hour call. We're going to now close with part 1 of our subject, and we're going to start with number two.